The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
So the NBA wasn't the only championship in Phoenix yesterday. You also had the U.S. National Championship for Irish Dance, hosted by I think it's the Convention Center in Phoenix, and there you saw your champion in the under 19 category, who also happens to be the lead for Celtic Throne. So that's very exciting for all the young people around here to see Jude doing well, not only for the show but. Also in some of the competitions. It's nice to see some competitions opening back up after a year and a half of total lockdown around the world. So a busy and tiring day yesterday. Of course, we come back to some busy activity here on campus in Edmond, the SEP program, the summer educational program, where we're going to have a fair bit of Irish dance instruction. And we also have the July 11th Celtic Throne performance. That's this Sunday. Hard to believe that we're just a few days away from the final show. It's completely sold out, but we do have the live stream available. If you go to CelticThrone.com, you can at least watch the performance online. And in the coming days, we might also be announcing an additional show. Given that we've sold out all the tickets for this Sunday, maybe 3-4 weeks down the line as we gear up for another college semester, we might have an encore performance of Celtic Throne. So we'll certainly keep you posted on that. Welcome back, by the way, to the Trumpet Daily. I'm your host, Stephen Flurry. I appreciate Richard Palmer from our UK offices filling in for me on yesterday's show. The next few weeks, as I said, are going to be pretty busy with camp. So you're probably going to be getting a fair bit of camp instruction since we don't have as much time to prepare our normal news gathering and routine and notes preparation with some of the other activities. I'll also probably be having a few extra subs filling in for me like you saw yesterday. But still, as I say, you'll be able to experience some of the camp experience or the camp life here in Edmond for the next 3 weeks. Lots and lots of youngsters that are very excited, and I know our college students, all the staff, the workers, they're very excited to be hosting this camp, and it's hard to believe that we're already back. I want to start this opening segment with a press release from, this is a few weeks ago actually, so it's not breaking news. Sam forwarded this to me this morning, but this was an announcement from Merrick Garland's office. He heads up the DOJ. On June 24th, he said that they had crossed the threshold of 500 arrests from the January 6th protest. And you read this statement, this press release, and it's almost like they're bragging. Hey, we passed 500. We're on our way to even more. That's kind of the tone of it. It really is hard to believe, particularly when you lay it alongside everything that happened last month. When did you hear, and this was even under Bill Barr, when did you hear an announcement from the DOJ saying, yeah, we got 500 people involved in burning down Minneapolis? You never heard that. You saw them getting a slap on the wrist, those thugs that were destroying American cities. But here, I mean, they're so proud. Listen to this statement. It says, the Department of Justice reached several benchmarks in our investigation into January 6th. We've passed benchmarks. This is awesome. It says we've now crossed the threshold of 500 arrests, including 100, the 100th arrest of a defendant on charges of assaulting federal law enforcement officer. Assaulting a federal law enforcement officer. That went on all the time, in every city almost, last summer. How many people were arrested and were waiting in jail for months after assault? There was all kinds of assaults going on right outside the White House from the end of May and the early part of June last year. How many? You remember the reports? We covered it on this program. Something like 50 from the Secret Service that had been injured? Did all of those assaults, were they prosecuted? Were indictments handed down? No, of course not. If people were arrested, they were, generally speaking, let out the very same day or maybe the next morning, thanks to the helpful assistance of Kamala Harris and people like her on the radical left. It says here, this morning we arrested our first defendant on charges that include assaulting a member of the news media. they're just, this is like their resume. Yeah, we've had quite a lot of accomplishments here. We've passed quite a few benchmarks. We got one for assaulting news media. We've got 100 for assaulting the law enforcement. And over 500 arrests. We're really excited. We're really excited about this. It says here, our efforts to bring criminal charges are not possible without the continued assistance of the American public. To date, we have received more than 200,000 digital tips. So, American citizens, basically giving a tip to the DOJ. Hey, I live next to a strong Trump supporter. He was there on January 6th. You might look into this. 200,000 people, 200,000 tips. This is the United States of America. I mean, this reads like something put out by the CCP. We've passed the threshold. We've met certain benchmarks, and we're continuing on. This is the biggest Department of Justice investigation in history, for a protest that brought on no death, except for Ashley Babbitt, shot and killed by a Capitol Hill police officer who's been carefully protected by Nancy Pelosi and the others. I think everyone now knows who that officer was, but nothing's happened to him. He shot an unarmed woman. I mean, just flip the table and put that event last summer sometime and flip the races too. A white police officer shooting an unarmed black woman. Yesterday, the U.S. Capitol Police, by the way, they announced that the agency is opening regional field offices in Florida and California. The Capitol Hill Police, they're opening offices around the country. I mean, this is I was going to say bizarre. But really, I think scary is a better word. Capitol Hill offices, police offices around the country. There, if you look onto some of the comments online and such and see how that the Capitol Hill police are immune from so many of the rules that sort of govern other law enforcement agencies. And you've got Nancy Pelosi behind this. I mean, think about where you've heard on this program just the many abuses of power with respect to the DOJ and FBI. I just talked about one. Do you think they're going to abuse their power as they get out into the country and find out, oh, here's some more dangerous comments that we saw on Facebook? Kind of a veiled threat to AOC or some other senator or congressman. And then working together with the DOJ or FBI. This is from Conservative Treehouse. It says, in a remarkable display of how committed the Democrat Party is to utilizing the narrative of domestic extremism for their own benefit, Nancy Pelosi is placing satellite field offices for the D.C. Capitol Police in key regions around the country. It says, when we consider the FBI has field offices all over the country, you might ask, why does the Capitol Hill Police need to expand beyond Washington, D.C.? I mean, we've got FBI agents all over the country. And now here comes more federalized law enforcement. It says here, essentially, what Nancy Pelosi is doing is expanding the federal law enforcement mechanism of the legislative branch into specific areas where they can investigate political opposition armed with legal authority. It says, this is a concerning shift in events. However, there is a likelihood such a move is connected to the larger political goal of enhanced federal enforcement to quell any rebellion while working in concert with the DOJ. See, they're mobilizing the troops to squash any kind of political dissent. And really, the Bible tells us to judge by fruits. Look at that statement released by Merrick Garland. We've crossed the threshold. We've got 500 of them. And the New York Times, as you heard from this program last week, they come out with the big video investigation, all the ominous sounding music. And yet they carefully structure this narrative to make it look like that you've got these rabid Trump supporting, dangerous, violent criminals. When in a lot of cases, as other video footage that the New York Times is not going to show, it's revealed that the police were really egging them on. You know, as I've said before, doors were opened up wide for the protesters to just stream into the Capitol. This is from the LA Times. It says the field offices will be in the Tampa and San Francisco areas. At this time, Florida and California are where the majority of our potential threats are, a department spokesperson said in a statement. This is all from just yesterday. The field offices will be the first for the department. A regional approach to investigating and prosecuting threats against members is important, so we will be working closely with the U.S. Attorney's offices in those locations. Wow. So they're expanding their reach so that they can get out to the threats. And there's evidently there's quite a few more threats in Florida and California. So we need offices. We need agents. We need Capitol Hill police to make sure that, well, the worst event or attack on America's Capitol since what? 1814, some have said. Just crazy. A protest gone awry. It lasts for 2 hours. Everything settles down. The senators and congressmen return to work, and they do their business by the end of the day. Switching back to conservative treehouse, it says, see this for what it is without getting too granular on the specifics. A federal political agency will now coordinate with federal U.S. attorneys on specific targeting operations. In essence, the Florida and California offices of Pelosi's police will, that's a good way to put it, that's what this is. It's Pelosi's police. Here they were just trashing law enforcement all last year, saying that they needed to be defunded. This is the opposite of defunding the police. Now Pelosi comes along and she's expanding police powers. What a change. What a dramatic shift. Defund. The police, they're the problem. Well, not now, evidently. Now we need more Capitol Hill police, and we need them all over the nation because we got to protect the senators. We've got to protect the congressmen from those evil and dangerous Trump supporters. This really is vile, what we're witnessing here. There's a satanic spirit behind it. Conservative Treehouse says this is completely political. There's no legislative or constitutional process for a subsidiary federal law enforcement agency to exist. This appears to be a new construction outside the boundaries of the legislative branch and quasi-constitutional form, quasi-constitutional from the framework of the executive branch. I'm trying to find this this tweet by Tom Elliott. He sent it out about how that basically in the Constitution you have, he said here, amazing how the Constitution has a very short and specific list of things the government can't do, and yet almost everything the government proposes doing falls on that list. everything that the Constitution says that you can't do as a government, well, this is what the radical left is doing. And nobody's standing up to it. Nobody's speaking out except Donald Trump, but that's why they want to squash him and his supporters. They want to remove all political dissent. My father in Great Again, he talks about the radical left and the movement to take over police. Think about it. When Donald Trump was there, it was defund, attack the police. And you can go back to that article we had at the Trumpet. I think it was in the summer of 2015. The war against the police. I mean, this has been going on for years. And then they steal the election in November. They've installed the fake president. And now look at what they're doing. They're expanding police powers. They're wanting to federalize it. My father says in Great Again, the federal government under Mr. Obama fueled people's mistrust of their local police forces, playing up the seriousness of these problems. It says one reason was that his administration was positioning itself to step in and solve them while taking more power to itself. See, get rid of the local agencies. We can't trust them. We can't know for sure if they're going to be radical Democrats. And so let's expand this power on the federal level. That way we can have some control, and that's what they want. They want to control law enforcement. They want to expand the power so long as they can govern it, so long as they can use it to abuse people, ordinary citizens of the United States. It says here, well, I'll just skip along. I don't want to take too much time on this. My father says, here is some more truth. The president had federal staff moving into cities and taking over police departments in order to straighten them out. I mean, this is just some recent history that my father covers during the Obama years. All right, and then you have the 4 years there with Donald Trump, God intervening. And then now the fake president's back in there, and look at what's happening. It's just an extension of Obama's policies. My father says the federal government was grabbing more and more control. It had a stranglehold on the police. The Obama administration seemed to view each new prominent race-related police story that exploded into the news as an opportunity to seize more control. See, never let a crisis go to waste, as Rahm Emanuel once said. So here's this, in large part, it's a man-made crisis because it's created by the radical left and the news media, the propaganda media, the January 6th protest. They turn this into the most frightening development in the United States since Pearl Harbor or even the Civil War. Someone the other day said that it was worse than 9/11. I mean, what an insult to the families of the victims of 9/11 to say that January 6th was worse than that? And that's what they're saying, these communists. They want to get as much mileage out of this as they can because they want control. That's their mentality. That's their mindset. They want to control people. They want to control all the levers of government. Yesterday, Jen Psaki commented on what needed to be done to make sure everyone got vaccinated. Listen to this soundbite, clip two.
President will outline five areas his team is focused on to get more Americans vaccinated. One, targeted community by community door-to-door outreach to get remaining Americans vaccinated by ensuring they have the information they need on how both safe and accessible the vaccine is.
Door-to-door outreach. That's the mindset here. I mean, they might be in for some surprises with a few of these doors that open up. Door-to-door outreach? To intimidate you into getting all of these toxins put into your body? Here's the fake president from earlier this week as well, clip three.
Special focus on five ways to make gains in getting those of you who are unvaccinated vaccinated. Because here's the deal. We are continuing to wind down the mass vaccination sites that did so much in the spring to rapidly vaccinate those eager to get their first shot and their second shot, for that matter, if they needed a second. Now we need to go to community by community, neighborhood by neighborhood, and oft times door to door, literally knocking on doors, to get help to the remaining people protected from the virus.
There's Big Brother. There's the nanny state. Not door to door. $330 million. And think about even just the cost of this kind of a program. The cure is worse than the disease. But you talk about big government. You talk about Big Brother. Door to door for 330 million Americans. And by the way, how would they know who's already had the vaccine or who hasn't? Here again, this is like straight out of 1984, George Orwell's classic. How do they know? And how much weight, if they maintain the position, we don't know, we respect privacy laws, we don't know who's gotten the vaccine or who hasn't. We're just going to randomly go door to door. Well, what about for the millions and millions of people who have gotten the vaccine? A tremendous amount of waste of resources, time, money, all those things. It makes you wonder. Maybe they know. Maybe the government is watching. They're certainly spying on a lot of people. So maybe they know more than we know with respect to who's gotten the vaccine and who hasn't. For the last week or so, I've been meaning to get into some of the skyrocketing crime statistics. And I noticed while I was in Phoenix, the latest from the July 4th weekend coming out of Chicago, 104 people shot, 19 killed. This is in one American city over the holiday weekend. 13 children wounded. Maybe we should start a door-to-door program to find the thugs in Chicago that are killing children. 104 people shot in one weekend? And yet all you would hear from the communists is that the problem is the guns. They want to take away the guns from you, you know, the people that live in Iowa or Nebraska or Texas or wherever. And meanwhile, there's guns all over the place in Chicago, a city that has strict gun laws, by the way. And people are getting shot by the hundreds every week. 104 people shot in Chicago over the July 4th weekend. The previous week, there was this story. I just didn't have time to get to it last week. It says Chicago Police Superintendent David Brown says there are too many illegal guns and too little consequences for the people who use them. That's why, he said, the number of shootings over the weekend, this is the weekend before July 4th, the number of shootings over the weekend from Friday, June 25, through Sunday, June 27, totaled 46 incidents. 74 people shot and 6 murders. So that's the weekend before July 4th. 74 people shot. Then July 4th, you had 104 people shot. They were celebrating, I guess, the holiday weekend. I mean, these numbers are insane. It's out of control, totally out of control. And yet, listen to Chicago's mayor try to brush these stats aside as if, oh, it's no big deal. This is clip 4.
Do you owe an apology to the victims of violent crime, the thousands of unsolved shootings and murders and stabbings and random stabbings in the downtown and the south side and the north side and the west side? Do you owe these people any apology?
So once again, sir, I ask you to get your facts right. Crime is not out of control in our city. In fact, crime is on the decline.
Wow. Okay, so I guess 104 people getting shot over July 4th, that's just normal. So hunker down. You know, you want an excuse for a lockdown. This would be it. If you live in a bad part of Chicago, and even there, a lot of times with the drive-by shootings, people inside of their homes get hit with a random bullet. 104 people shot, and there is the mayor of Chicago saying that crime is not out of control. And then if a reporter comes and presses her like the guy did in that clip, well, she can always fall back on how the fact that it's racially motivated, it's racist for you to even question her. This is clip 5.
Mayor, in recent months, there have been questions raised about your temperament and your reaction to criticism. Tribune editorial used the term irascible. How much of this do you think might have to do with the fact that you're a woman, and specifically a black woman?
About 99% of it.
99% of the criticism. In other words, you cannot criticize her. Just let her keep doing her job. Let the out of control crime continue, and she'll just keep saying it's just fine. It's perfectly normal. There's nothing that's out of control here, and if you criticize me, you're a racist. Listen to AOC talking about the crime wave statistics, not just in Chicago, but all over the country. This is clip 6.
We are seeing these headlines about percentage increases. Now, I want to say that any amount of harm is unacceptable and too much. But I also want to make sure that this hysteria, you know, that this doesn't drive a hysteria, and that we look at these numbers in context so that we can make responsible decisions about what to allocate in that context.
Right. Don't be so hysterical about these skyrocketing crime statistics. Just look at it in context. There's a member of Congress saying essentially what Mayor Lightfoot said. It's not out of control. Fox News had a graphic recently about New York City. 173% increase in robbery. This is 2021 compared to last year. A 201% increase in felony assault. And then an 800% increase in hate crimes. 800%? Hate crimes. That's in New York City. Listen to the police chief from Oakland, as I say. This is just something that's happening right across the country. Clip 7.
But today we find ourselves in a crisis. We find ourselves reeling from a weekend of violence where we've seen 4 homicides over a 3-day period. It now has us currently at 65 homicides for the year. It's a 90% increase compared to last year. Our shootings are up over 70% this year. Our robberies are up 11% this year. It's been 1,300 robberies in this city already this year. Our carjackings are up nearly 88%. So we see clearly that crime is out of control in the city of Oakland, and our response was for less police resources.
There's the police chief in Oakland saying, look, the response to all this crime is to reduce funding for law enforcement, to eliminate sections of law enforcement. That's someone at the ground level just reporting the alarming statistics. That AOC would say, look, don't get hysterical. And then if they do want to get to root causes, of course they're going to blame Donald Trump. And then throw in racism somehow or another. The war against the police, that was the headline at our magazine, thetrumpet.com. If you aren't a subscriber, remember, tomorrow's news today, that takes you back to 2015, what we were saying. Call our operators, 1-866-930-3024, and request your free subscription to The Trumpet Magazine. Just a few other clips here that I haven't had time to get into. Donald Trump, I forget if it was this past Saturday or maybe it was the rally before, or it could have been an interview with Sean Hannity or someone on Fox about how that he was talking about the cognitive test that he took when he was president. And then he suggested that Joe Biden should take one as well. And, of course, that's never going to happen. But listen to what – and the reason I want to play this for you is Joe Rogan has – now, I don't listen to his show, but I've read where he has the most popular podcast in the country. And listen to this casual exchange that he has regarding Joe Biden's cognitive skills. This is clip 8.
We don't really have a real leader in this country anymore. I mean, you could say Joe Biden is the president, he's our leader, and you'd be correct on paper, but I mean, everybody knows he's out of his mind. He's barely hanging in there.
Everybody knows he's out of his mind. He's just barely hanging on. That coming from the most popular podcast in the United States. So here is this fake president installed by an Antiochus movement. You've got the puppet out front, but then you've got the puppet master, Barack Obama. You've got a lot of the same people that worked for Obama. They're now in the Biden White House. And we're supposed to just play along with it. This fraud, this corruption, this massive power grab, all of the stealing that's going on. There was a letter sent out today, or a series of them, from a Pennsylvania senator, by the way, Doug Mastriano. He said, this is just from this morning, "Today, as chair of the Intergovernmental Operations Committee, I issued letters to several counties requesting information and materials needed to conduct a forensic investigation of the 2020 general election and the 2021 primary." So these are some interesting developments. You know about what's happening in Maricopa County. It's taking longer than I'm sure most people would prefer. But then you've got the push to forensically audit those ballots, those absentee ballots in Georgia, 147,000 of them. And now here comes this state senator in Pennsylvania calling for, he visited Arizona, by the way, the recount there. And he liked the fact that it was so scientific and secure, and the transparency was everywhere. You could actually view the count online. Observers all over the place, quite unlike November 3rd. Mastriano says, "We have asked these counties to respond by July 31st with a plan to comply. The counties represent different geographical regions of Pennsylvania and differing political makeups. Some are Republican, while others are Democrat, which means that this will be a balanced investigation." It says, finally, these are just a few excerpts from his document, this op-ed that he posted this morning. It says, "This is necessary as millions of Pennsylvanians have serious doubts about the accuracy of the 2020 election. A January poll from Muhlenberg University showed that 40% of Pennsylvania voters are not confident that the results of the 2020 election accurately reflected how Pennsylvanians voted." They're not 40%. It's nearly half the state. And you would think the governor of the state, he doesn't support this, by the way, you would think he'd say, "Look, just in the interest of setting their minds at ease, let's go ahead and have an audit. Let's go ahead and have an inspection." I mean, think about the massive, oversized, bloated government that we have and all of the inspections that they have going on into everything, except when you come to this and you've got the communists in the media, in government, saying, no, we don't want any kind of a recount. We don't want any kind of an inspection. And of course, they hold this position because they're trying to cover up the obvious fraud, the theft. It says, "Discounting or mocking the concerns of this 40% block is neither an answer nor proper in this constitutional republic." So here comes a government body with subpoena power. And I'm sure, like with Georgia and Arizona, it'll probably get tangled in the courts. And who knows how long that this will drag on. But it is nevertheless being exposed. And like my father has said in numerous articles at our magazine, The Trumpet, the website, of course, is thetrumpet.com. God says that it will be exposed. A lot of it is. Even as we speak, you're listening to Stephen Flurry, and this is The Trumpet Daily. If you'd like to email the program, you can submit feedback by emailing us at td@thetrumpet.com. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. A child is a miraculous blessing from God, an opportunity to build his family. In his word, God says to train them up in the way that they should go, so that when they are old, they will not depart from it. But how should you train up your child?
most parents do not know. Most parenting books offer only limited help because their authors do not understand the purpose and potential of your child's mind. As a result, millions of children grow up to be hopeless without any direction in life. Many come from broken homes. Many do not have a home. This is why so many young people become delinquent, rebellious, and unsuccessful as teenagers and adults. But you can rear successful, jubilant children and avoid the heartache of an unhappy and miserable home. God has outlined how to rear obedient children in His Word. Our free book, Child Rearing with Vision, will show you how to raise children that follow after God's abundant way of life. It will help you build a strong, united family. It will help you bring God's love into your child rearing. And it will guide you through the momentous journey of preparing your child to serve God the Father forever. Request your free copy of Child Rearing with Vision at our website, thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
The other day, I told you about those the statues that had been pulled down in Manitoba, I think it was, the statues of Queen Victoria, and then also Queen Elizabeth II, the current Queen of England, and the protesters wanting to do away with Canada Day. They're out there in full force pulling down statues, and I guess they don't have any law enforcement powers on hand to prevent that sort of thing from happening. So crazy. The things that are allowed that law enforcement just turns a blind eye to. And then on the other hand, you've got Nancy Pelosi's police expanding their powers, expanding their reach so that they can intimidate, so that they can persecute, so that they can squash political dissent. Queen Victoria, by the way, she served on that throne of David for 63 years and 7 months. She was the longest serving monarch until 2015 when Queen Elizabeth II passed her. She's now up over 70 years. These are some remarkable ladies if you look at their lives. Queen Elizabeth, for example, she was 25 years of age when she ascended to the throne. This goes back to 1952. And millions and millions of people. TV was just coming on as a technology, and I think something like 27 million people in Britain watched the coronation on live television. Millions more listened in on radio. And this is from the Spectator, writing at the time. It says the Queen's own, well, this is actually writing at the time of when she passed Victoria as the longest reigning monarch. It says the Queen's own patriotism, a faith in the courage and character of her subjects, has informed her approach to her reign. Her approach has been one of service. Her daily schedule would alarm and exhaust someone half her age. This was when she was, I guess, in her early 90s. Her daily schedule would alarm and exhaust someone half her age. And her approach has been one of service. You can go back to some footage captured, or at least it's on YouTube. We've played clips before, but she was a princess at the time. She's 21 years of age. It was on her 21st birthday, I guess, back in 1947. And she talked about this motto, this noble motto, I serve. She said those words were an inspiration to many bygone heirs to the throne when they made their knightly dedication as they came to manhood. I should like to make that dedication now. I want to make that dedication before all of you, the British people. I want you to know that I'm here to serve you. I'm here to help. She said, I declare before you all that my whole life, whether it be long or short, turned out to be long, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong. It says, but I shall not have strength to carry out this resolution alone unless you join in with me. So I'm here to uphold this noble motto, I serve. And I want for you, the British subjects, I want for you to commit to this as well. We need to do it as a nation. This is another time period, isn't it? We certainly don't see this kind of service-oriented attitude or just patriotic spirit. It's gone today. That motto, by the way, I serve, it dates back to the 1300s and the first prince of Wales, Prince Edward, I think it was. He was out on the battlefield somewhere in Europe, and he comes upon this slain German monarch, and he was wearing an emblem with the phrase written in Old German, Ich dien, which means I serve. And this English prince, he took up that crest, and he made the motto his own. Think about that for a moment. A soldier out on the battlefield, he sees this inspiring motto on the crest of a slain German soldier, and he says, I want that motto. I want to live by that. What a noble calling it is to serve. Notice Matthew 20 and verse 20. You think about this with respect to our calling, soldiers in God's army. 2 Timothy 2, it says here in verse 20 of Matthew 20, Then came to him the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons, worshiping him and desiring a certain thing of him. So here come the sons of Zebedee, James and John, and then the mom was involved as well, but basically it was these two disciples that really wanted a chief seat next to Christ himself. A pretty bold and audacious request. They didn't yet have God's Spirit. They lacked humility. But notice what Christ taught them. It says, and he said unto her, what will you? And she said to him, grant that these two, my sons, may sit, the one on your right hand and the other on the left in your kingdom. She wanted them, and they wanted to be right under Christ in God's kingdom. Verse 22, and Jesus answered and said, you know not what you ask. Are you able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of and to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said to him, the boys, that is, the mother, they said to him, we are able. Well, of course. It was like Peter who said before Christ was crucified, I will never deny you. Never, never. I'll never do it. And he ended up doing it three times. That's what happens when you put your faith and your trust in yourself. Christ here says, are you willing to take from the cup that I shall drink of and to be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with? Verse 23, and he said to them, you shall drink indeed of my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give. But it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father. So Christ went on and prophesied that, yes, you are actually going to drink from the cup that I drink from. He could see ahead, knowing that these two would have a change of heart once they receive the Spirit of God, and that they would make sacrifices, that they would serve in the work. James ended up being martyred, and John, of course, was exiled to the island prison of Patmos. So these were disciples that really did serve Jesus Christ for the rest of their physical life. Verse 24, it says, and when the 10 heard it, the other disciples, that is, they were moved with indignation against the two brethren or brothers. But Jesus called unto them and said, you know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and that and they that are great exercise authority upon them. So you know how leaders work in the world. They exercise lordship. They oppress. They're power hungry. I mean, they want control. Verse 26 says, "But it shall not be so among you, but whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister." So here is the key. Christ is explaining. Here's the key to greatness. This is true leadership. You've got to be willing to minister unto others. You've got to be willing to serve. I mean, that's what the Greek word for minister means. We call those who are set apart as ministers in the church. And you can see all the various ranks in Ephesians 4. But we call them generally, we call them ministers. They're servants. That's the way it is in God's family. The ones in positions, the ones that are in positions of leadership are servants to the people. What a noble, noble calling. I serve. That's what God has called all of us to do. It says, "And whosoever will be chief among you." So he takes it a step further. Let him be your servant, or in other words, your slave. Let him be a slave. Let him take on a slave-like mentality. You want to be a leader? You better be willing to serve and minister. And if you want to be chief, well, then you have to have the mindset of a slave even. That's the attitude that Jesus Christ had. Look at what he did in his ministry. Look at how he sacrificed all for you and me, for the whole world, for all of humanity, for people who despised him and who wanted to kill him. And they did. And yet still, Jesus Christ laid down his life. He certainly has authority. He said, "You call me Lord and Master," and that's good. He was their master. But he was a master quite unlike the masters you see in the world today and that you saw back then in the first century and that we've seen all through the 6,000 years of human history. Verse 28, he sums it up by saying, "Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many." So here is Jesus Christ, the greatest servant of all time. He came to serve mankind and to teach us, those of us in his church, God's church, to teach us how to be servant leaders. That's really what our calling is all about. To take on this same Christ-like mentality, to let this mindset in, as it says in Philippians 2. Let's notice that, Philippians 2, 5. It says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus." Now, notice what type of mind was in Christ, because we've got to let it in, right? Verse 6, it says in the Revised Standard, "Who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped." I mean, he was the Word before he humbled himself and came in the flesh. He wasn't minding his own things. He came in the flesh to make the ultimate sacrifice. He came in the flesh to look on the things of others, as the earlier part of this chapter says. Verse 7, it says in the Revised Standard, "But he emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men." So every motivation from Christ was unselfish. He was utterly unconcerned about his own reputation, his position, his status. He wasn't there in the first century to do his own thing. He emptied himself, as the Revised Standard Version says on verse 7. He impoverished himself. He made himself of no reputation. He became, Paul said in 2 Corinthians 8, he became poor. He was a God being. There was God in the Word, as it says in John 1. And then he came as lowly flesh and blood. Verse 8, it says in Amplified, "And after he had appeared in human form, he abased and humbled himself and carried his obedience to the extreme of death, even the death of the cross." So he humbled himself to come in the flesh, and then, I mean, the final humiliation, obedient unto death. crucified, scourged and crucified. God laid all the sins of the world on his shoulders. What a sacrifice. Verse 9, it says, "Wherefore God also has highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name." So it's just like Jesus was teaching in Matthew 20. If you humble yourself to the point of this kind of sacrifice, if you're willing to go all the way with Christ, if you're willing to follow his steps, even if that means withstanding all kinds of persecution, trial, test, and so on, then God in the end will highly exalt you. That's what God's looking for in his kingdom, in his family. These are the people that he wants to exalt and promote. These are the people he can use, servants. Verse 5 again says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus." I mean, this is very rare in the world today. God speaks of his servants, his saints, as precious jewels in Malachi 3. Jewels are rare. It's rare for leaders today to serve their subjects, to serve their people. Notice an example that's referred to later on in this same chapter, Philippians 2, verse 19. It says, "But I trust in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy shortly unto you, that I also may be of good comfort when I know your state, for I have no man like-minded who will naturally care for your state." So we know about Jesus Christ and the willing servant that he was. And here Paul says about Timothy, he just naturally cares for your state. And he said, "I don't have anybody like him." He's an amazing servant in the work. Verse 21, it says, "For all seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ." See, so many others, even in the church, he's saying, were more selfishly motivated. And he's just bringing to the attention of the Philippian brethren that, you know, Timothy, he's rare. The kind of godly service that he churns out, what a rarity, even in the church, laying down his life, his time, his talent, his energy to help others, to mind the things of others, to just naturally care for you. Verse 22, it says, "But you know the proof of him, that as a son with the Father, he has served with me in the gospel." I mean, he just serves. He serves with me in the gospel. He minds the things of others. Paul goes on and gives another great example, Epaphroditus, in the next several verses. I'll just leave that for you to study, since we're about out of time. But let me go back to the start of this chapter, Philippians 2, verse 5, of course, "Let this mind be in you." But notice what it says in verse 3. It says, "Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than themselves." Don't let anything be done through strife or vainglory. Just mind the things of others. Verse 4 says, "Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others." Be a servant, in other words. Don't concern yourself with your own things primarily. Look on the needs of others. That is what we in God's church, that is what we in God's family have been called to do, to serve. I serve. What a noble motto that is. If you'd like to subscribe to our Trumpet magazine or order any of our booklets, I think of the God Family Vision or John's Gospel, The Love of God, tying in with what we just covered here in this study, be sure to call our operators, 1-866-930-3024. And also, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to get some feedback from you. If you'd like to email us, td@thetrumpet.com. Let us know your listening habits. Let us know where you're from. Tell us a little bit about the way you approach the program, and we'll perhaps get it on the air at some point. You are listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.